Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT podcast. Today, we're going to talk about massive hemoptysis. We're not going to talk about it on the basic primer level. We're going to talk about sort of a masterclass on massive hemoptysis. I am not alone. I am with my friend, Oren Friedman. He is pulmonary critical care with an emphasis on the critical care. Oren is a true intensivist. He is a true resuscitationist. He is someone who you want taking care of your sick patients if they get up to the ICU. He used to be in a medical ICU at Cornell in New York City. He's now switched to a cardiothoracic ICU with an insane focus on ECMO and mechanical circulatory devices at Cedars-Sinai in LA. Oren has been on the show before to discuss the management of massive pulmonary embolism and submassive pulmonary embolism. If you haven't heard those episodes, go listen. He is so good. Along with his colleagues at Cornell, they created one of the first pulmonary embolism response teams in the country. And it's funny, but now I have Oren on talking about another disease that requires interactions of all different services in the hospital. It seems like these are the areas that he is really masterful on, is the coordination of teams to take care of patients that require, like, not just one consult, but four, five, six consults. We'll get right into it, but if you've never heard anything about massive hemoptysis, you might be lost on a lot of the stuff in this episode. So I have some links in the show notes on some basic discussions of the causes of massive hemoptysis and some of the terms you're going to hear. So if you really have no clue what we're talking about, stop for a second, go to those links, read the stuff, and then come back and finish listening to the episode. Let's get right to Oren Friedman on massive hemoptysis. Okay, so you're walking by the ED. They pull you over. They had just intubated a patient who has been coughing up massive amounts of blood. They just stuck a big ET tube in. They stuck a 9-0 in, which is the size, if you get it, you want, or an 8.5 if you can. And you're walking by, they grab you over and they're like, Oren, help us out. We got a patient with massive hemoptysis. What are your next steps?
Well, actually, I like the point right off the bat that you're just saying tons and tons of blood, and you're not getting obsessive with those ridiculous, is it 200 cc's and 300 cc's in 24 hours? And it drives me nuts when people sit there on the phone and start trying to obsess over whether it meets criteria. And this, I think this situation, you just know it when you see it. When it's a ton of blood that's pouring out of the airway, you know you're in trouble. When it's a little bit of scant hemoptysis, okay, not a big deal. So I just separated it into really, really bad and not a problem at all kind of a situation. So, you know, what you're describing sounds like, you know, as massive as it gets in sort of my mind. And I mean, look, the first thing, the first step is always establishing the airway, which I know you know. And I think before you start trying to overthink the situation, you have just got to get an endotracheal tube in some of these people. Now, I will tell you, so if the person is oxygenating okay and ventilating okay and not in respiratory distress and they have a good strong cough and whatever's coming up, they're able to cough it out, that is a very different person than the person who is clearly starting to either get altered, is so overwhelmed with the volume that they just can't cough frequently enough to clear their airway, or is starting to show any signs of gas exchange. And if any of that stuff is happening, you got to move very quickly to an airway. If that's not happening, you may still need to move to an airway because all the stuff that's going to come down the road is going to require that. So first step is an airway. Big, large, huge, single lumen tube. You know, you may have already gotten to this, but, you know, I think trying to, you know, configure double lumen endotracheal tubes, especially when that's not something you do on a regular basis, is number one, really hard to do. And the other problem that people don't talk about a whole lot is if you put in a double lumen tube, you know, the next step, which is what you should be doing, which is an urgent bronchoscopy, often a lot of the therapeutic scopes won't fit through those double lumen tubes. You end up with needing a pediatric scope. You're not going to be able to clear the airway. You're not going to be able to see very much. So I love it. Big, fat, as big as you can get. Use a bougie, big single lumen endotracheal tube. And your next step is to grab not a pulmonary critical care doctor, but a pulmonary critical care doctor. So someone who is like a real critical care thinking kind of a pulmonologist.
Now, what Oren's alluding to is easier to understand in print, but what he's saying is you want a critical care doctor, boldface, who just happened to have done their training in pulmonary, as opposed to what we have in the United States a lot of the time, which is pulmonary critical care, but really critical care is not their emphasis. They're primarily pulmonology, and critical care is kind of a sideline or something they do very infrequently. Maybe they take like one shift of call in the unit every so often. But no, you want either a true critical care doctor who has a pulmonary bent or a pulmonary interventional guy or gal. Either of those would be the perfect person to grab.
Who isn't going to play around with whether or not this person needs a bronch and where they should go and trying to be too brainy about it. Honestly, I think all these people deserve an urgent bronchoscopy, starting off with a flexible, certainly urgent imaging, chest x-ray, and you're really going to need a CAT scan here too, and we'll get to that. But once you establish that airway and you get decent ventilator exchange, you got to get somebody who's willing to be pretty brazen with and active with a bronchoscope. And so this is going to isolate the bleeding in a lot of the people. I mean, you're really going to figure out where it's coming from. Sometimes there's frankly so much blood in the airway, you just have no idea, you know. But even in some of the bad and extreme situations with really, really aggressive lavaging of saline and inspection and that type of thing, you can get a sense first, at least, is it coming from the right side or the left side, which is huge. And then to take it a little step further, like what lobe it's coming from. So I think right in the outset, that's also going to tell you some important things like, is this the kind of person that I'm going to be able to get any control with a flexible scope? Am I going to be able to stop the bleeding at all with a flexible scope? Is this person going to need a rigid bronchoscopy? Is this person going to need bronchial artery embolization, or does this person need surgery? So while you're doing this bronchoscopy or while you're getting all the equipment sorted out, you got to call in your like necessary players. And it's great to make allies in different fields, because massive hemoptysis is like one of those kind of multidisciplinary diseases where, depending on the case, you may need the surgeon here, you may need your IR guy there, you may need your interventional pulmonary guy or your thoracic surgeon. I think from hospital to hospital, sometimes the IP guys and the thoracic surgeons overlap in some of their abilities.
All right, so you're at the point you're about to do flexible bronchoscopy. I'm a surgical critical care guy. We were trained one way, and then the pulmonary critical care guys were trained another. As in, we do kind of a half-assed job, and you guys are really spectacular at this. So why don't you give us your tips and tricks for flexible bronchoscopy?
Okay, so I would divide this into the people that you could potentially fix with a flexible scope that you can get some control. The people that are going to need like temporary blocking to just literally, you know, plug the area off and keep the rest of the lung, keep the rest of the lung protected. The people that are going to need rigid bronchoscopy, and then the people that are going to need eventually bronchial artery embolization. So I guess like first off, there are a fair amount of people that you can still fix with flexible scopes. And it really just depends on your skill with a flexible scope. So there's different stuff you can do. If, you know, say for instance, you're find like a defined bronchial lesion, like a tumor that's growing into the airway or something like that. There are some of these people that can chill out, you know, just by using cautery if you have a pulmonologist who actually has cautery through the bronchoscope. Generally, most places that tends to mean that you need to find someone who does a little bit of interventional pulmonary or find a thoracic surgeon to help you. So there are some people though that can respond very well to that, and that's a very direct bronchial lesion. There's also the people you're going to find on flexible scope that clearly are bleeding from one segment of the lung, but you can't actually see something in the bronchi that you're going to be able to fix. But you can try giving some medications through the bronchoscope and some different therapies that may be able to send it distally and get it to stop. And those things include iced saline. No one's exactly sure why this works, but the feeling is, you know, it's so cold that it causes vasoconstriction and can stop the bleeding. And so if you really, really ice down saline and lavage it, I mean, honestly, you can get control in some of these situations. The other thing is dilute epinephrine. It's the same epinephrine that you would use, you know, say to numb somebody up, to suture them.
So I clarified with the Soren. What he means is he's actually using the lidocaine 1% with epinephrine. So that's the lidocaine is kind of a bonus, but the epi in the lidocaine with epi is what you want. I suppose it could be lidocaine 2%, but you're at much higher risk of toxicity that way. So they're grabbing the lidocaine 1%. You'll hear shortly he doesn't actually do this very often. He uses phenylephrine. But if you're going to use epi, that's how he does it. I imagine there is no reason you couldn't just mix this up yourself with just epi at the right concentration, which I believe is 1 to 200,000, even though we're not supposed to use that terminology anymore. And that would be a way to avoid lidocaine toxicity entirely. And that might be preferable, but the reason he doesn't even care is because he's not doing this. He's using phenylephrine.
You can mix that up, or you can just get that from pharmacy. And you can give that 1 or 2 cc's at a time down the airway. And that, again, works by vasoconstriction. Phenylephrine will also work, by the way. The same concentration you can mix up on your phenylephrine sticks that you're going to push for hypotension. You know, just put that thing directly into the airway. I think it probably works as well as epinephrine, and then doesn't give you all the tachycardia. So that's another relatively easy thing. I mean, that's some, actually, to be honest, you don't need a lot of skill there. You just get your bronchoscope, you see bleeding, you put a bunch of phenylephrine down there and see if that helps stop. So the other thing, actually, my colleagues back at Cornell developed, Dr. Rajwani, Dr. Sanso, one of our pharmacists, Dr. Ramos, they started using instillation of Amicar. And what they would do is they would dilute down that normal 5-gram load of Amicar to the point that you had a gram and about 10 cc's, so 1 gram and 10 cc's. So you basically dilute down Amicar that just comes that you would give for, you know, say a post-cardiac surgery patient or whatnot, and deliver these 10 cc's aliquot. And they're having tremendous success getting some control of the bleeding with that. I actually haven't personally used that, but I told them they should write this up. I think it's actually had a lot of success with that. So a little Amicar too can go a long way. But again, that's off-label, not a lot of research behind it, but just anecdotally that seems to have worked. So that gives you an idea of some bronchoscopic therapies that you can have to stop the bleeding. Now, sometimes, like, again, it's just too much blood, or, you know, this stuff is not working. Like, you're putting this stuff down there and the blood's just, you know, coming back at you. And then you got to make the decision of one of two things. Either I'm going to give up on that entire side and I'm going to try to, you know, mainstem intubate this patient. Obviously, you described someone on the right side, which means you want to left mainstem intubate them, which is going to take you're going to have to use some bronchoscopic guidance to get that single lumen tube down the left. Obviously, when it's conveniently on the left, all you have to do is just push in and it'll go right down the right for you. Now, most of my experience doing that in these really sick patients with hemoptysis is that they get so extraordinarily hypoxic from shunting that it's not exactly something that they tend to tolerate very well. So that's a difficult thing. That's kind of a pretty desperate maneuver. If you feel like you can isolate it to a segment and the bleeding is slow enough that you have a little bit of time to deal with some things, you don't have to just ram the tube in, then that gets into your whole endoscopic endobronchial blockers. And, you know, those things can be pretty nifty. They're whole different types of different ones that are out there. A lot of people have that aren't endobronchial blocker in stock, and that's okay. It's awfully tricky. It's got this little loop that you have to grab around your bronchoscope and guide it in. And I find that really, tricky. There's one that's built with a little bit of like an angle to it that just helps you direct. And I'm actually blanking on the name of that, but that one's actually really super useful.
So the one Oren's talking about is the uni blocker. It's the one I have experience with, and I agree, it probably is the easiest one to use. I will have videos on how to use the uni blocker in the show notes for this episode.
One thing I will say is that even with those really big tubes, it can be pretty hard to get both your bronchoscope and an endobronchial blocker down the endotracheal tube. I mean, that's not always such an easy thing to do. And then if it's a tight fit, it's very hard to pass your blocker. So one thing that I've done on a couple occasions is to literally intubate them with the endobronchial blocker. Just drop the endotracheal tube cuff, pass the blocker, pass the cuff, and just then it's on the outside of the tube, and then you can use, you know, your bronchoscope to guide it into the right place.
And one trick I could recommend for that, if you're having trouble getting it there, is the same split tube technique I've demonstrated on the podcast to get things into the esophagus, like hypothermia esophageal temperature monitoring probes. If you make one of these split ET tubes, you could actually put that right at the top of the existing ET tube, so it's like right at the glottis, and then pass your blocker through that, and now you don't have to get the blocker to transverse the oropharynx. Now it's right at the cords. You drop the cuff of the ET tube, you pop it through, you advance it down, you reinflate the cuff of the ET tube, and now it's there. You can pass it down to the carina under bronchoscopic observation, twist it left or right depending on which side you want to go to, and Bob is your uncle.
There's this new easy blocker that the thoracic surgeon, thoracic anesthesiologists love now. They say it's basically got two little V's to it. It lands itself right on the carina, so you can either isolate one lung or the other. It tends to fall nicely into place, they say, most of the time. It's something I haven't used myself. One good tip I have is that, you know, make friends with your cardiothoracic anesthesiologist, because they're always blocking people's lungs for different thoracic surgeries and stuff. They know what you have in stock in the hospital. They know how to use this stuff fairly well. So they're actually a kind of a useful person to have at the bedside when you're trying to get an endobronchial blocker into place to help manipulate the airway, get it in and bend it, that sort of thing. So I would say if you can isolate it down to one segment, like really would try to just drop that segment. I would really, or that lobe rather than the whole lung. Like I said, every time I've tried to drop the whole lung in one of these situations, again, terrible, terrible hypoxia. They almost never tolerate it very well.
Now, when we've been talking about this in the past, you've also mentioned the utility of a cryoprobe placed through the bronchoscope. How does that fit into the management of hemoptysis?
It's almost like the reverse flip side problem of hemoptysis, which is you think it's great when they stop bleeding, like, woohoo, okay, the bleeding stopped. But, you know, I've had a couple of situations where, okay, the bleeding stopped, but their airway is literally completely casted with a huge blood clot. I mean, total cast to the airway. And I've had a couple of situations where, you know, bleeding stopped, but you could not oxygenate, you couldn't ventilate these people because the entire airway is literally filled by this massive blood clot. And getting blood clot out of an airway with a flexible scope is sometimes extraordinarily difficult, especially when it's like not really firm, it's just rubbery. So you try to grab it with endobronchial forceps, it doesn't want to come. It's too gelatinous to come up through your suction. It's this very desperate feeling where you're just like, I see that stuff and I can't get it out. And that's where cryo is amazing. Again, it's something that, like, probably mostly it's going to be your interventional pulmonary people and your thoracic surgeons who are going to maybe have access to it. But it's not, really terribly, like, hard to understand why it works really well. It's basically this flexible catheter. It's going to go out through your working channel of your bronchoscope. You're going to have a foot pedal that's going to freeze the tip of this catheter. It gets super, super, super cold. I mean, you can see it like literally crystallizing and turning to ice when you freeze this thing. And when you bury that into stuff that has water in it, like biologic material, like blood and things like that. And by the way, food and foreign bodies that have water in them, it turns to ice and hard, and you can pull this stuff out. Now, you don't pull it through your working channel. You take your whole bronchoscope out with this big frozen chunk of, you know, blood clot. And that's one of the best things to get out that massive blood clot if that's your problem. So that's where I would say cryo has its best role in this situation. Yeah.
Okay. So what we've said so far is you've protected yourself. You've put on a N95 mask. You've put on eye protection. You've intubated the patient with a 9-0 ET tube. You've gotten someone, or you yourself know how to do this. You've gotten someone to bronch to localize which side it is. You've gotten a smarter person to bronch, and it may still be you depending on your training, to actually see if they could find a discernible lesion that they then will try to actually either give medications to or intervene on directly. But now you found the side, it's right-sided bleeding, and you haven't been able to stop the bleeding with any medications or what have you. So you actually now have performed blockage using an endobronchial blocker to the segment that actually had the blood pouring out of it. And now you've temporarily temporized the situation, but the patient's still going to be bleeding into that lung. And so now you got to do the next step.
So first up, you know, make sure that all the general bleeding, coagulopathy stuff, like with any bad bleeding patient, is addressed. Because there are some patients who are just bleeding terribly and will really just stop with proper resuscitation, and whether it's plasma and platelets and cryo and all that good stuff to get people to stop bleeding. So you got to make sure you crossed off all your boxes there. The next step is, okay, you crossed off your boxes there, they're still bleeding, you've isolated the lung. Then I'm really thinking down the lines, if you've got good IR people that are aggressive, this is where things like bronchial artery embolization come into play. It's going to work better the more defined of a thing it is and the more bronchial of a thing it is. So, you know, the bronchial arteries supply areas around the bronchi themselves. So if it's a tumor eroding into a bronchus, will potentially work really well there. If it's bronchiectasis with bad bleeding, will potentially work there. Identifiable lesions like masses. When it's, again, a diffuse process all over the place, your likelihood of bronchial artery embolization is probably not going to work so well. your guys are probably going to want a CT scan with contrast. And I've come to understand why they always ask for that. And that's because some people have these really difficult to find bronchial arteries. Some people have blood supply to the bronchi that are coming off of collaterals from their intercostals or even down through their subclavians, and it's not fed by their bronchioles. So they're not just being annoying when they ask for that CAT scan before they want to take them. This is actually something that's going to really help them out. And now, having watched them do this a few times, I mean, it is like finding a needle in a haystack. I mean, just even cannulating into those bronchial arteries that can be so small, it can be painstaking. So kind of having a sense of where they're coming off is really important for these guys. So, you know, get your CT scan, get your CT angio, however they want it protocolized. Call them in and see if they're going to willing to have a go at it. If that's the step you're going to go to, by the way, you should also be already calling your thoracic surgeon, because if that's not going to work, then you're talking like, you know, lobectomy and segmentectomy and all that sort of thing.
Now, you must have known this was coming due to our shared interest in this topic, but it would just seem to me that at this stage, patients too sick for bronchial artery embolization, or they're trying it and it's failing, it would make a lot of sense, rather than taking that crashing patient to the OR right away, to first put them onto VV ECMO. It just seems ideal for this. Now, during my fellowship, I never had a massive hemoptysis patient to put on, but at least in everything I understand about the disease and about VV ECMO, this would be the ideal case. It would be a short run because it's just a bridge to getting the patient some definitive bleeding control. Even if it's not optimal oxygenation, I don't need this guy to be satting at 95%. I'll take 80 for a few hours simply to be able to get him to either the OR or to IR to get the artery embolized. So is VV ECMO the way to go in these patients who are really crashing after initial stabilization attempts?
Yeah, I haven't had someone like that. I'm sure now, being at Cedars, it's only a matter of time where we're going to put someone on VV ECMO for massive hemoptysis. I think if they're that sick, it totally makes sense.
Okay, anything we missed in our discussions thus far?
You know, take-home messages for people are big single lumen airways. Get airway control. Make sure you review the history to, you know, make sure that, you know, that's not an obvious lesion that's going to pop up and it's clear where they're bleeding from. You know, early flexible bronchoscopy, but realize the limitations of flexible bronchoscopy. You know, and I think the key is, like, a lot of these emergencies is having your allies in the different fields that can help you. Know your IR guys, know your thoracic surgeon, know if you've got an IP guy that does either rigids or has access to cryoprobes and that sort of a thing, for sure. Sure, of course. Oh, one little thing I just thought of too. So, okay, I was thinking of something. You know, I've seen some of these people that have this diffuse alveolar bleeding, number one. So a couple things with that. So I found that actually relatively high mean airway pressures and high PEEP can sometimes almost pneumatically tamponade it or keep it sort of in place where it's not bubbling up into the airway. So, you know, be fairly generous with your PEEP. And almost the reverse is true. If you can't tell where someone's bleeding from, sometimes what I'll do when I'm bronching them, temporarily disconnect them from the ventilator. And it'll sort of wash up in your face a little bit from the area that the bleeding is coming from. So the positive pressure can literally make someone who, you know, just had massive hemoptysis, suddenly you look and you can't find anything. And you're like, where did it go? So disconnect them, it'll sometimes pop up on you. So that's another little tip. And one last little tip. When you're doing these bronchs and these people that are this tenuous, you know, please think about taking them off the ventilator and having somebody ambu bag them by hand, you know, connected to the side of the endotracheal tube with a bronchial adapter so you can bronch through it, rather than having them hooked up to the ventilator because the problem is your scope's going to be down there. The ventilator is going to be alarming with high peak airway pressures. It's going to be kicking off all the volume. They're not going to be ventilating. If you have someone sort of slowly push past the resistance of your bronchoscope, that's a much safer way to bronch people when they're really having this kind of a disaster.
And of course, regular listeners of MCRIT would know, alternatively, you could do what we do during CPR and keep them on a volume control mode, but raise the pressure limit settings to something high enough to guarantee delivery of the breath. Now, if you are not familiar with what that means, how to do it, and how to ensure it's happening, then just listen to Orin and switch the patient to a BVM and have someone give reasonable tidal volume breaths with the BVM, and then you avoid having to rely on a ventilator that you're not intimately familiar with. Can't thank you enough for coming on the show again, dude.
Sure. You know, I wanted to tell you, I said, some people think like the pinnacle of their academic career is like getting published in the New England Journal of Medicine. I will tell you, I would much rather take being on your podcast than any New England Journal of Medicine article. So this is a total honor.
Oh, you're too kind. You've just made my day.